This is the Liam Sheff Show on UCY-TV and Truth Frequency Radio. Hi, welcome. Be quiet, guest.
Shh.
Hi, welcome. Hi, welcome to the Professionally Mastered and Recorded Liam Hamburger Helper Show. This is the Liam Sheff Show, American Heretic. Yours truly with one of his best friends in the universe. It's Ms., Mrs., and Miss April Bowden of Truth or Talk, of AidensRecovery.wordpress.com, of the Sunrise program that she's going to tell you about, of being a mother of six or seven kids, seven or eight kids.
Yeah, something like that.
More happening every time we talk. There's another one.
Yeah.
Look at my purse. It's another kid. This one's going to be a lumberjack, Liam. Okay.
No, there's just the three. Oh, but I think that joke comes from because I just popped out the third like a couple years ago, and it was a surprise to all of us, I believe, because I was old by then, and my other two kids were old by then. Am I right? So it's, you're making a joke because it was kind of a shock.
You are old. You're as old as me. Imagine trying to have a kid at my age.
I know. I did have. I mean, a couple. Well, about a year. Yeah, you know, she's a year and a half. So. Yeah, a little bit ago.
How did
but
you do
still,
it?
Yeah, I was already old.
Such a healthy child, too. How did you... April, by the way, just give your website so people know who we're talking with.
I am April Bowden at Truth or Talk, truthortalk.com, and Aidens, recovery.wordpress.com.
Okay, and you're everybody's favorite on the internet, and everybody knows you from your UCY, your years and years, your decades of programming at UCY.
Right.
Were you and your partner, Ulette, she has a new name apparently, did a comedy review.
Mm-hmm.
I was on it 1,200 times.
You were on it, yes, at least 1,200 times.
Right.
Somewhere in that realm. We had you on very many times. It was so much fun to always have you on because we didn't take ourselves too seriously. I think that's why it was easy to come on our show for people to enjoy themselves and relax. Because even though we talked about serious things, we always kind of managed to be silly about ourselves, you know, and not take it all so hard. And it was a good time. And we did it for like 3 years. We did this podcast, weekly podcast, and I almost started it up again, but I just, you know, with the family demands, like you said, I have 7-8 kids. It's really hard, and we live in a shoe. And
you have 3 children and a newborn.
Mm-hmm.
You have I've met your kids.
And
we're going now. We did used to have fun in the show, but of course, behind every smile is a tear or two. So there are some difficulties, and I will let you describe them to the degree that you want to describe them. I will say that they are hardships in the truest sense of the word, and that you deal with them with an equilibrium that most people couldn't muster. But even so, you're one person, you're one mom, you're one lady in a world with a working, hardworking husband so you're juggling these three kids. Mm-hmm. all day long. You're homeschooling, you're doing all manner and variety of things, and one of your kids, well, you should tell that story.
Yeah. Well, the listeners of Truth or Talk know this because I would talk about this just about every episode, and the people at UCY, most of them know this, but I have a son who is diagnosed with autism. So, which means that he's vaccine injured. He was vaccine injured when he was a toddler. And he regressed. He lost language. He lost ability to communicate. He started to flap and do odd behaviors, just as many people describe as what you see. These kids, they're everywhere now. I'm sure people know what I'm talking about because you see them at the grocery store and you see them at the movies and you see them at the restaurants, and they can't sit still and they're having a hard time just being out in the world, the things that we all take for granted. So that's Aiden. He's in a state, I call it in a state of autism because I don't like the diagnosis itself or the label. I think it's a state of being. It's a state of mind. They're being in a world of isolation because the world is too much. It is overwhelming because they cannot absorb the things around them. They cannot filter things out, extraneous information. Everything comes at them at once, so they create very, very highly sensitive people, and they just become overwhelmed and can be start doing these flapping things to try and cope. Can sometimes be aggressive, as Aiden can be, to try and cope. And that's what it's like to be in a state of autism, especially for those who are like Aiden, who would be considered on the severe end of the spectrum. And he's also nonverbal, so his form of communication is very limited. And he has a little bit of sign language, and that's really pretty much about it. So yeah, it's a hard life. It's hard to on a day to day to just manage and to regulate him and just to keep him in a state where he's not feeling so overwhelmed, because he gets overwhelmed very easily. As in many ways that, I mean, it's we're living in a time where it is overwhelming for a lot of people. But I mean, if you could just imagine that you were walking through a mall for 6 or 7 hours, and you just hear all the screaming, everything, and all the lights and all the things going around you, to be in a state of autism, I imagine it's like that all the time, even in places where it might not seem as overwhelming to you because you have the ability to filter things out. They don't. So it's pretty heavy.
I'm,
And
oh, sorry,
you
go on.
had.
No, 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 no,
No,
no.
no, no. You finish. You ask your question.
I
I don't
refuse to
remember what I was going
speak.
to
I refuse. I will
say.
not trample your words.
Go ahead.
Okay. Maybe. I'm a highly sensitive to sound, noise, to some kinds of visual stuff, but I can actually bear a lot of visual stuff. I don't know what that is. I can take in so much visual information. I'm sometimes not even okay unless I have a book, a magazine, a video screen. But give me unpleasant noise, and I think all of today's music is unpleasant noise. Now, I go into the Chipotle where I'm sometimes found to be eating their, diseased organic non-GMO food. They had a health scare, as you know. I've never had a problem, but their music selection is picked by this. I'll just say this. This isn't. I'm not quoting you. I'm saying this myself. So if you're coming after anybody, Chipotle, come after me. Your loser, hipster, New York, make-believe, over-the-hill, just your terrible music d decisions. Your terrible music decisions, Chipotle. You think that I'm there? Do you really genuinely think that I'm there to reinvigorate my taste in Soho grunge trust fund baby pop? Really? Wrong. Wrong. Wrong.
That's what they play on Chipotle radio.
Chipotle. Just when you go to Chipotle, they actually have a loser hipster somewhere cresting 50 who picks all their crap music for them, and it's ungodly. And Jesus weeps and Muhammad cries. Everybody is upset. Krishna crawls in his little shell. I didn't know he had one, but it's bad. Anyway, I'm overwhelmed by loud music, so I'm often going up to them going, "Hey, it's just a little bit loud." And I hate your food now because my taste association is ruined by sound. So I'm somebody who's always turning things down. I can hear radios like in other rooms, and people, if people want to know if I'm a quiet person, yes, I'm a quiet person. It's not hypocritical. I don't like being loud, and I don't like loud. So imagine that times every sense, every sense.
And then you can't really tell anybody, you lack the ability to tell them how you're feeling too. So there's that human need to be understood, right? The human need to be understood, and it's that's just a basic feeling that we all, and it's so hard to communicate with people even when you have the ability to talk, even when you're highly verbal. I mean, just imagine if you just couldn't say anything, and even trying to learn sign language was a struggle for you, even trying to, you know, but you can understand. That's the thing that's really odd about language, is that it's not just about talking. It's actually, that's a very minor part of it. But your receptive language, your ability to understand and read body language and to hear and know what people are saying, so that you can do that part of it. So you can understand what people are saying, but you can't talk back. You can't say anything. So when they're getting things wrong about you and they're talking about you as if you're not in the room, and can you just imagine that level of frustration of just being closed off and not having that? You can't say, hey, that you're wrong, that I don't like that, or I'm not, that's not my favorite color. You know, just,
Oh,
go ahead.
No, it's crazy making. Now, my mother is, listen, we all love our mothers. I love my mother, but my mother is pretty narcissistic, and she would stand in front of me and explain, like a lot of people's mothers have done this, but tell people who you were and what you, and you just look at them like, what the bloody curse words in your face are you talking about? There's nothing to do with me. And I was prohibited. I would squirm, but I was prohibited from saying much, or else, of course, I'd get in trouble. And if I did say something, I might get in trouble. And then, you know, you figure that the adult that your parent is talking to is sort of on your parent's side, even though they look at you sympathetically, because, you know, the adult is the one has to deal with the other adult. So they're like, I hope you get out of this prison soon. You know, I remember a lot of adults looking at me like, kid, learn a hobby, because it's going to be a while. Don't go crazy. So imagine growing up with the normal, or even slightly abnormal in my case, the more intense knocks and pings of parents who kind of suck. And now give yourself good parents, but you can't even complain, and you can't find the words, and then they say something to you, and you can't process it. And what's left? But well, your son has outbursts. He'll outburst. He'll have a physical explanation, I suppose, right, of his feelings.
Sure.
And that can be rough.
It can be, and it's. I mean, people can imagine if you haven't experienced this, it's pretty much like the outburst of a toddler. You know, you never really get past that, because when they're in that period of their development, that's when the vaccine takes their progress or anything that they're going to do past that away, stops them right there. Boom, you're in a time warp, and you're stuck there, and you're going to age, and you're going to continue to develop receptive language, so you're going to continue to have more complex thoughts and feelings, and you know, your body changes, and biologically you're developing into, he's 11 now, so you know puberty happens, all those things happen, but you can't get past being about the level of a one-year-old when it comes to being able to communicate. So when you're that, you know, you can imagine you've gone now 10 years without being able to tell anybody how you feel, and you go places and you're overwhelmed. You know, he hates the music at Chipotle's too. He hates the music at Sharky's. You know, wherever we go, he hates their music, because that's just not his thing. I don't know if he hates the music, but he hates it, you know. He hates probably people and the onlookers and the people who give him looks of disdain, because again, too, remember, it's not, he can understand, and he understands body language very well, and he understands when people are giving him the dirty looks, or, you know, and I know he does, because usually people who do that, he'll kind of hover around them and get close to them, and I'm like, okay, back off, you know, don't knock that person out, because I know he's probably thinking it, and he hasn't done that, but I mean, he can become aggressive with, you know, with me, and certainly, you know, can have little outbursts and things like that, or throw himself on the floor, or, you know, try to stop traffic, or try to do things that you know, just whatever it takes to get his point across, because he hasn't the ability to do it in a normal way.
Right. So we're actually talking about a dangerous situation, and it's been very hard on you at times.
Yeah.
So much so that you've begun to reach out for some support, and maybe you'd like to talk about that.
Yeah, because we've decided to change the way that we've run Aiden's program. See, Aiden, as I said, he's 11, and you know, I mean, as you know a lot of autism moms. You know, autism moms are pretty well researched. They're pretty. We kind of run the gamut, and we'll do whatever it takes, and find whatever diet that's out there, and we'll find whatever treatment that's out there, and we never want to leave any stone unturned. And because we just can't, and we just keep moving forward. There's nothing else to do but continue to move forward. So it's just that's just how we roll. And so we've decided to change things because what we've been doing so far with Aiden hasn't been successful. Now most of the treatments that are out there for kids with autism focus on the behavior, and it's suppression of the behavior. So you have a kid who has self-stimulatory or they have aggression issues and so forth, and you want to try and suppress that. So, or you want to try and redirect that and put that into put that area of intensity into something else. And it's not particularly successful, especially with kids. It certainly hasn't been for Aiden. And it's kind of acts like a game of whack-a-mole. You drop one thing and then another thing arises. And sometimes the thing that arises is worse than the thing that you knocked off in the first place. Like, for example, if you take away a stim only to add more aggression, because he's doing the stim for a reason. It probably has something to do with regulating himself, or maybe because our kids are also vaccine injured, remember, so they're in a lot of pain all the time. And they have to also try and compensate for that. So they're reaching out, doing things with their bodies. This constant, repetitious movement, a lot of times, is for pain management. So when you're trying to take those things away, sometimes you can actually make things worse. And that's what we've seen happen. So Sunrise program is the direction that I'm moving into, because Sunrise works not on suppression, but rather on acceptance of what they're dealing with and acceptance of who they are and, you know, just loving appreciation. I look at it as kind of a radical difference from most of the other things, because it's about radical acceptance. And that doesn't mean you don't want your child to get better or to heal. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's just that you aren't going to try and suppress the things that they need. You won't tolerate things like aggression, but if he wants to play with a water bottle and tap on a water bottle instead of, you know, running trains or cars, that's fine. You know, because that's normally how you would run it in most of these programs. They'll try to redirect that behavior into, like, well, let's do something that's more normal or more typical. Well, we're not going to do that. We're going to just allow, I mean, who cares really? Because it's how things are developed sometimes. How did the game Kick the Can come about? You know, they didn't have anything else, so they used a can as a toy. So it's fine, and you're looking at it as just joining the child in their world, trying to become part of their world, and give them a motive to come into yours. So if you're not being accepting and loving to them, what's the motivation on their end to say, well, yeah, I'd like to play your game and like to be a part of what it is that you're showing me, but when you're not showing them the respect for who they are. So Sunrise tries to retrain your brain to think in those terms and on that level, and then how to be a part of the child's world and in bit by bit reach them and to have them come into yours. So it's not about giving them rewards for doing good things or giving them praise for doing something right, you know, oh, you used your fork. I mean, you can certainly praise them for things like that, but it's more about the relationship itself is the reward. So you're not going to give them, you know, a lot of these behavioral programs will use candy or use, you know, treats. They love to use food because food's an easy way to give kids a reward. It's an instant gratification. So this doesn't use it. It's the relationship itself is its own reward. So you're trying to build a relationship with the child. And but it's a heavy, intensive program. We're trying to fund my tuition and my husband's tuition to go. And we've made about halfway there, so we still have a little ways to go. We want to get both of us out there in December, and Once the program is funded, once we're able to go and get our training in it, then we will bring that back home and teach people in the community how to do it as well. So it's not just the burden on us. So it's also the people in the community who want to volunteer their time and come into our house, and we'll teach them this program, and then they can get hands-on training and work with Aiden. And so it's kind of a lovely thing because it actually incorporates the community and gets the community involved and gets them listening and understanding these children on a whole different level. And it really brings communities together, and they can take that information that they learn from being in our home and working with Aiden off to other children who, you know, they might know in their community or in their own families, and, you know, and or if they belong to the church or whomever they're working with, because these kids are all over the place, so they can take that and work with the other kids. And it's just, and from my perspective, I mean, if you think of it in terms of, you know, if you're a child and, you know, you've had countless parade of people coming in as therapists, and they're doing a job, and they're spending time with you, they might get attached to you, but if they get a better paying job, they're going to leave. But these are people who are volunteering their time out of the goodness of their heart. And so that alone is just going to be healing, because the child will just feel that. They can just feel the difference of a person who's there for a job or there because they want to be. And so so I'm really fond of this. It's something I've always wanted to do. And I learned about this years ago from a woman named Angela Williamson. Angela Williamson was she's my friend, my partner in crime. Yulette Verstein Henry, her cousin. And she had introduced me to Angela because Angela has also a child with autism on the autism spectrum. And so years ago when Aiden was first diagnosed, that was her, well, you know, you can talk to my cousin. So she set us up for a call, and Angela was the first one to tell me about the Sunrise program. And her, she had been through basically the same thing that I've been through. She'd gone through every different system and every program that was out there, and then finally made her way over to the Sunrise and had really wonderful things to say about it. And so it's kind of strange that here I am in the same position 9 years later doing what she did, you know, having gone through everything. So I didn't listen then, or I did, but I didn't think that I could get there or that it was possible. But now I've changed my mind, and I think that it's more than possible. So
how do people help you, and how much do you need left for the tuition, and how do people help you?
I think we're at about 1,900 that we need still, and that will pay for both tuitions, and I mean that'll complete our fundraiser, and that's covers both tuitions and the plane, and because it's in the East Coast in New York State. And they can go to the blog, Aiden's recovery.wordpress.com, and I have a page called the Sunrise Fundraiser that they can click on, and then there's a link to the You Caring fundraiser, and they can just add to it, and it has all the information about the program and about Aiden and why we're doing this and so forth. So
make your plea. Pitch it to people. Why should they help you? They need to part with $10 or $20 or more if they can. So,
yeah,
you have to ask when you're asking for money. You do have to ask. So go ahead.
Well, anybody who has $5, $10, $20, $30, $50 to spare, or whatever amount they can spare, please go to my site, aidensrecovery.wordpress.com, click on the Sunrise Fundraiser, and make a donation of whatever amount that you can afford. And the reason why you want to do this is because, you know, it is our responsibility as a community. We're going to be taking care of these kids. It's not just the people, the parents, but all of us. And so this is something that benefits the entire community. It's, as I said, it's not just for Aiden. It's all the people that are going to be involved are going to take something away from it, and they're going to be able to bring that to all the other children in their lives and around them. And so that's why this is unique, and that's why this is a big deal. And we all have to take responsibility for this, because, you know, quite honestly, we allowed this to happen. to our children by not by never asking what's in a vaccine and still letting these kids get injected. So I would hope that people would understand that and then say and want to take care of Aiden and the children like him. And so hopefully this will work and will benefit everybody. Go ahead.
Do you have PayPal and other means of donating?
I have PayPal.
Okay.
I have PayPal.
Well, that should work.
Oh, okay.
No, go ahead. Say it.
My PayPal is april243@sbcglobal.net.
Okay. april243@sbcglobal.net. aidensrecovery.wordpress.com.
Yes.
Okay. This is the Liam Sheff Show, American Heretic on UCY TV and Truth Frequency Radio. Please be generous and give up your Netflix subscription for a month or two and help change somebody's entire life. That sounds pretty reasonable to me. We will be back in just a few seconds. We don't have long, but if you... Let me think. Do you want to... Why don't you give me a 5-minute encapsulation of Vaxxed?
Okay,
hold on. And we're back. April Bowden is with us. She's going to talk about the movie Vaxxed. I've talked about it. I recommend that you see it. My only consideration was that they favored the Luc Montagnier and the AIDS lie, so that bothered me and still bothers me. But I support the movie. Absolutely. It's doing very good things. April.
Yes.
You'll be our film critic.
Mm-hmm. Well, like you said, that was cringeworthy during the scenes where they did support the AIDS lie. But other than that, it was a very accurate depiction of what happened to our children, basically. I mean, as a mother, I walked in there with – I've been doing this for 9 years, so I didn't think that there was anything in this movie that I didn't already know. I mean, I had already seen my child – regress into autism after receiving the MMR vaccine. I'd already seen, you know, hundreds. I've talked to hundreds of moms and parents over the years, mostly moms, but some dads, where this has happened. And so it wasn't, to me, I didn't think I was going to go in there and be surprised by anything. But it was very emotional because it was sort of everything that we had experienced played out in front of us, and this acknowledgement or this realization that it was just all based on these lies, and these people went in and, I mean, if you guys don't know, I'm sure Liam's talked about it enough on the show, but there was a CDC whistleblower. So a guy working for the CDC who helped write these research papers that said that MMR vaccine was not connected to autism has now come out and said that whole thing, that they lied, they withheld information, and they did know that there was a connection all along. So it when you think of that, you think of how many people have been damaged, it's pretty hard not to feel overwhelmed with emotion about that. Because that sort of surprised me, because I thought that I understood, you know, I knew everything that they were going to say just from experience and years of research, my own research. I was even pretty certain that they lied about all this research and data. And if people really want to go deeper, I mean, there was I think it was 2005, a Congressman Dan Burton, and he had a report about vaccines that went into a congressional hearing. And even if you look through that, and it's boring to read, so most people aren't going to be able to get through it. But they knew then too that there was that was mostly focused on the thimerosal and the vaccine. But the point is that time and time again, it's come out that this is this has been known by everybody in charge and all the establishments about, and they just cover it up and bury it. And then they just let, you know, this Holocaust happen where it's just person after person getting maimed and killed, or, you know, neurologically impaired for life and physically impaired for life. So it's awful. So as a mother, that's the story. That's the story of Vaxxed. And, you know, they did a good job putting it together, and it's an important film, but it's still very heartbreaking for me, because I can't believe that they allowed any that anyone allowed these things to happen. I you know, I'm still baffled that, you know, such evil exists, that you can just allow so many hundreds and thousands of children to get just get disabled, and it's really sad. And
is there any idea of how many autistic children there are in the country right now?
I think that the number is like 1 in 56, and that in boys, mostly boys, because boys outnumber girls 5 to 1. So
really,
yeah. It's, so it's something that affects more boys than girls by a lot. Gender has a big...
Oh! I thought you meant there were more than there were 5 times as many boys in, as female young. You know what I'm saying? You mean it affects them more often?
Yeah, there's more boys diagnosed with autism than females.
Than females. But
yeah,
there aren't
five times
as many boys in the country as there are female.
No,
children.
No. Just in autism.
Because that
alone.
Would be bad for
yeah.
the future.
Yeah. Well, it is bad for the future, right? Because where
yes.
are the men, you know, going to be if they're all disabled? So many, it's more men who are being affected. But, I mean, you know, the females are getting it in other ways, as later when they become teens, they'll get hit by Gardasil. They'll get knocked out in that way. But as far as the autism diagnosis, it's boys 5 to 1.
Mm. That's okay. So I'm just wondering about population demographics, how many people under the age of 15 there are in the United States in 2016. I'll have to go look that up. You mentioned politely that my audience, the 18 drunk people who listen regularly, may know about William Thompson of the CDC, because I would have told them, no, this show is a stream of consciousness, curse-filled ramble. I don't worry about hitting any particular topic for more than the 38 seconds that my mind alights on it like a hummingbird.
Right.
No. I mean, I talk about things that are on my mind. Usually I talk about the psychopaths, and sometimes I'll talk about the psychopaths and the varieties of science. I'll often talk about religion, because religion is a story that you were told when you were a child. People, stop it. Wake up. Story mm-hmm. you're told when you're a child. So tired of
right.
that. It's a story you're told when you're a kid. Please stop it. Please apply the same critical thinking across the board. If not, the, you know, the Hour of Power or whatever show is on another network for you to enjoy. April, I love you dearly. I'm not kicking you off the show. You can stay longer. You're doing mothering duties. You're doing blogging as we speak. You recommend the movie. I recommend the movie.
I do.
I remain miffed with the guys who made it for not responding to me, for me asking them if they could provide the absolutely accurate quote from Montagnier for the record, and why they didn't check his film bio. He appears and is featured in House of Numbers, in which he says a number of startling things about the HIV fraud. And I, you know, hold that against them, because you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dead men, and mostly men, and some women, who've been killed by AIDS drugs. So if you're fighting, this is... But I support the movie, because the active Holocaust is now turned toward children, and that's the vaccine Holocaust. And of course, you know, Dell was a mainstream guy, and then he's turned around. You know, he's said, wow, there was a lot that I didn't know. It was just right there in the fine print, and gosh, I didn't bother to read it, because, you know, everything was working out so well for me, I guess. And then something in his compassionate heart said, no, I have to listen to these people who are standing here with arms outstretched, just begging for somebody to acknowledge that they're, you know, that they have a case. Mm-hmm. So support the movie. Oh, anything else going on? Your show archives, are they available?
Yes, they can go to truthortalk.com, listen to the show archives. We've had so many great guests on our show, including Liam Schiff
and
many others.
And, yeah, Jim, what's his name?
Mars.
Jim Mars, yeah, Jim Mars. And
oh, yeah, we had Jim Mars. It was awesome.
And Sean.
Sean Stone.
Sean Stone.
Sun Stone. And we had Gwen Olson, who are Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher. Mm-hmm. We had... She's a rare one to get on your show. So that was really cool. And
cool.
Who else would we have? I mean, just a bunch. You can check out our archives, truthyourtalk.com. And it was a nice run. It would have been nice to have lasted, but it's a lot of work running a show. So, and I had to focus on the fam for a while.
Yeah.
So it's something for sure I could like to come back to. But and we always, I think that we have a really nice group of people at UCY. So.
Yes. Well, it was tough. You know, after Leno took the Tonight Show back, and then there was the new guys coming in. You know, just advertising rates went up so much. Right. It was hard to keep it on the air.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you know, I think, didn't TBS offer you several million?
I had to turn that down.
Yeah.
Who wants that? Who wants several million?
Is Conan still on the air, by the way?
I think he is.
That's
I don't
amazing.
Really watch. Yeah, I don't watch his show, but I think he's on the air.
That's
I mean,
incredible.
Yeah.
I don't understand television. All right. Now speak. One last thing. Oliver's new movie is coming out. Have you seen that?
Oliver Stone has a new movie?
Yes. It's one word title. You know what it is?
No.
Snowden.
Snowden. He's gonna go there. Okay.
Yeah. I saw it and I got a little lump in my throat and a tear in my eye and I said, God bless you, Oliver Stone.
Yeah, right.
Taking on those shaggy dog truth or issues that nobody else. I know that to get out of some sort of DUI prostitute sting, he made a World Trade Center.
I haven't seen it, so I don't know. I don't know what's his World Trade Center.
It's upsetting.
Is it?
Yeah, it's just nothing. It's not nothing for the guys who survived being trapped in the World Trade Center and then got out, but it's not a movie. It's not an Oliver Stone movie. I'm not sure what it is. But then he went back and got involved in the South American politics, as he should have done, and showed that Chavez, for being whatever he was targeted by the U.S. probably for oil and for oil interest. So, you know, it was kind of a return to form, and now it looks like he's coming back even further and saying, you know, this guy knew things and went over, you know, revealed them, and now he's the most wanted man. It's just information that he's dealing with, after all. Mm-hmm. Just information.
Yeah, that'll be good. I mean, I love JFK. I mean, who doesn't, right?
Probably the CIA.
Yeah, but we talked to Jim Mars. He's, if you don't know, he's the one that wrote the book that JFK is based off of.
Crossfire. He read my book.
He's a cool guy. He's really a cool guy.
He's definitely a sweet. He
man.
Is a nice guy. I like him. Hmm. I don't know why he went so alien stuff though. What he did.
I don't know either. I'm not really certain. I mean, his latest book, apparently he even goes into vaccines and the pharma industry and all of that. I haven't read it, but it sounds good. But the alien thing, I mean, I would imagine that he wanted some money. I don't know. maybe that's where the money's at when it comes to the conspiracy stuff. People like to believe in aliens because, as you often say, we're a myth-making species.
Oh, yeah.
And so the aliens are the gods and the goddesses of yore, the stories, the fables of Greek mythology. You know, you can turn the aliens into that. I mean, if you ever watch that show, Ancient Aliens, my husband likes to watch that sometimes. And it's on the History Channel. And it's fascinating. I mean, I mean, how accurate is it? I mean, all these guys, the historians, and then they say, well, is it possible, you know, that what they're really talking about in the Bible, that an alien ship came down, you know, and it's just, I mean, they're creating another myth. It's fun to watch. It's entertaining, but, you know, that's what myths are. They're very entertaining.
Right, right. Yes. And no, it was, you know, probably us coming out of our tribal ancestry and remembering some of weather events and, you know, electrical events in the sky. Real history is very illuminating, but it's very hard to get anything resembling real history, especially out there on the Facebook echo chamber, where, you know, everything is done by the three people in charge in the Rothschild death chamber at the center of the world. Okay.
Right. The torture chamber.
Well, April, thank you so much for gracing us with your presence.
You're welcome.
And
Thanks for having me on.
can you give your information one more time
Yes.
to the drunken idiots who listen to this show? Thank you.
Yeah. Right. Each time I say the blog's name, it's your job to take a shot. Turn it into a drinking game. Aidensrecovery.wordpress.com. That's AYDANS recovery.wordpress.com.
And the program that you're investing in?
Sunrise.
Sunrise.
And you can find, yeah, and there was a movie made about it. Anybody can look that up and they'll find all kinds of stuff on it. So.
All right. Well, great. Now, listen, people, go give up Netflix for a month. It's $10 and just go put it into her PayPal. Just do it. Shut up. Go do it.
Thank you.
That's how I ask.
Yes, please do.
That's how I ask for things.
Just do it.
Just do it. Efforts.
Done already.
All right. Thank you for helping, my friend. Love you. See you soon.
Yeah. Bye.
There has never been a society on Earth that has been free. Society itself doesn't operate on the principle of freedom, no matter what our friend Tom Woods would like to think. Societies aren't free. They're more free for very wealthy people and less free for non-wealthy people. Wealthy people are always determined by a kind of inheritance. And when you end up in a multicultural environment, they're generally determined by skin color and inheritance. I'd like to talk about these things. My name is Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. I'm the author of Official Stories. This is funded by you. Any donations into the PayPal are greatly appreciated. So, we pride ourselves on being a free people. We think we get up in the morning and have great freedom to get into our freedom boxes and drive to the freedom office where we push around the freedom numbers on the freedom computer and then go home and watch freedom Netflix and then go to sleep and sleep as well as we can on our freedom drugs. And of course, you know by saying that we're not free at all. We're slaves to a kind of ant-like farm in which we get up and perform perfunctory duties that are far beneath our will or our wants or our intelligence. Our dreams have been long shattered. We don't get to go to the places we want to because we bought into a particular lie that was told to us that managed our life and our wants and our needs, or we just bought into it because we were that kind of young girl or young boy who thought that the American dream was something to really fight for, and we ended up with a picket house and the double mortgage, and we're kind of going to hell looking at our DVD collection, which means nothing to us, even though when we bought the things at impulse, it seemed to give us a sense of that lightheartedness that we equate with freedom. We're not free. We're not exactly slaves, so what are we? We're ants. We're a kind of species. We're a mammal on the planet that goes around and performs duties to keep the society, the wheel, turning. All societies run on energy, but most societies run on human energy and sunlight and some animal labor. Our society does not use sunlight or human labor. It uses oil. So you can see that our society in caste and color will be radically different from all of the societies that have ever come before. We don't use human labor. There's a little human labor used to push the machines around, but we don't actually use human labor to do the work. Machines do it. People drive the machines, and we think that that's work. It's not. We'll figure out what work is over the next 10 years. We'll be right back to work, all of us, growing food and working out in the gardens and making the waterways and all the other systems that we're going to have to do to get the world to work on pure energy the way that it used to. So you can see that we're not quite free. We have to eat every day. We're thermodynamic. We have to eat. We have to take in energy. We put out less. Most of it disappears in heat. We're terribly inefficient. We're 20-25% efficient as a machine. Very, very inefficient. Most of it comes out in waste and heat. There's nothing we can do about that. So those of you who believe in the perfection of the species are misunderstanding what we are. We're a mammal on planet Earth, and we have our limitations. So freedom, then, is an idea that we were given by the concept of a founding fatherhood. Notice it's not a founding motherhood, but it's a founding fatherhood, which begs how there could be any children at all, except through this, the impregnation and, or slavery of women, who are apparently not included in this equation. There should be some, mental clanging at this point. There's a problem. And we're told that we're free because we can pursue happiness. Okay, we can pursue happiness. Very wise, by the way, to say that we'll never quite be happy. It's very clever of them. And they're right. We'll never quite be happy because happiness is fleeting. It's ephemeral. And the men who wrote these things were reading the works of Rousseau, and they were probably familiar with... No, Rousseau was later. I apologize. I take that back. 1700s. Maybe. I'm going to have to get my dates right. But they were reading the works of the early Enlightenment, so they were happy with the idea that we could pursue happiness, and this was a great freedom, but not if you were black or a woman. There was no concept of gay, of course, but you had to fit in with you had to fit into this sort of limited, 5% of what human beings actually are. You had to be a straight, masculine male who owned other people. You owned other people because we're not free, and our society didn't run on oil then. You begin to suss out the problem. So within our friends, like Tom Woods, come out and say, we're built to be free, and Jeffersonian, and who's the other guy? Payne, Thomas Paine. If you read Common Sense, you'll believe in the free. Well, if you have slaves, you can be as free as Jefferson wanted you to be. If you have an industry that can make things for you, you can believe in the banking system that Hamilton, I think, wisely wanted to set up to fund the rest of the creation of the United States on slave labor. But if you don't have that, you can't be free. You just have to get up and toil. And then you're back in the tribal state. You've gone immediately from the near industrial state of the founding of the America, United States, to the tribal state. Just take away oil, and you're way back there. If you keep coal, you're in the Georgian era of England, or the early Victorian. And everything is running on steam power, which means that people have to spend their entire lives digging coal out of veins in the ground. People in cities live in huddled, horrible conditions, covered in disease, with every kind of disease that you can imagine. And that's life. And even the wealthy have terrible disease. They just cover it up with wigs and, arsenic makeup and the rest of the stuff that they put on them. So we've never been free, and we're never going to be free. And I think that we have to change the discussion from, can we make ourselves into an absolutely free species, to, can we survive? Let's now change to that topic. Because in the era before we had oil, we couldn't really spend too far outside of the energy that we could bring in. Now, coal is full of energy, but you couldn't build, let's say, a flying airplane or around the world mail service, in an overnight kind of thing, on coal. You had to still move only as quickly as the steam piston could run, which was under a certain number of miles per hour. And it took labor, and people were involved in that labor. You still had to feed people, and you couldn't use coal-powered tractors to do it. If you didn't have oil to do that, you had to do it by tillage, by machines, by animal agriculture. And you essentially had to do it by hand and by animal labor. So we still had to have a lot of people working in the fields, and we were still an agricultural nation. So what changes about that? Do we not have enough oil and enough coal to run a perfect slave society in which we can feel free enough to get in that little shiny metal box, our freedom cage, and drive to the freedom office and eat the freedom GMOs and put them in the freedom microwave and go home and watch the freedom Netflix and not have freedom sex because we're too tired and we're on too many freedom pharmaceuticals? That's American freedom. I mean, we're free to get every disease in the world that's caused by the carcinogenic agents that are sprayed on all of our food. We're free to have terrible, terrible relationships because we're afraid to actually have more open conversational relationships because people will shame us based on the old rituals of the societies that we no longer remember that we came from that don't really apply to our society because we have so much energy, et cetera, et cetera. We're not really free, but we're ants. We're kind of ants in a system. We're mammals in a system. What happens when the energy goes away? We're going to become mammals in the system again, but the system is going to be smaller. Our towns are going to reroute the food system from 1,000 or 2,000 miles away on truck back. Still, we'll run trains and we'll run diesel ships that run all over the place because it's easier to power a diesel ship and a train than it is a truck. And so we'll have that kind of stuff for a while, but we'll have to, that takes time and there can be interruptions and we'll be desperate not to starve to death, so we'll begin growing food where we live. And places like Southern California will more or less dry up. Arizona, all the states that don't have plentiful water sources will go away, where the food by needs comes in from far away, will not be able to sustain themselves to, you know, something within 5% of their current populations or less. It's a prediction that I'm willing to stand by. If we could look at what 2116 looks like, I would imagine that the desert places of the world that are now inhabited by large populations will not exist anymore. I mean, you might have nomads, or you might have people, you know, around the oases, and they may have these very strict draconian laws about how to maintain a society around that kind of limited resource. But we won't be free, we'll be devoted to agriculture. I think being devoted to agriculture is where we're headed. I just want to present to you this idea of our freedom. Our freedom isn't freedom. We live in a structured society that is based on a lot of stories that we aren't even allowed to ask if they're true or not, with laws that we're never really allowed to overturn, with a government that's totally unresponsive to us because it can't be. It's, you know, it's a handful of people trying to talk to 320 million people. It's absurd on a pure energetic basis, you know, on a pure human communication basis. It doesn't make any sense. And you just have to look at it that way to understand. You know, a thousand people working in Washington can't talk to 320 million people. And you get it, right? It's all done. It's all over. Anyway, we're not really free. We'll never be free. You should stop talking about freedom and talk about survivability. If we could talk about survivability and not your freedom to get things from wherever you wanted in the world and not worry about the energy input, if we could talk about survivability, we would say, aha, we're never going to get everything that we want, but at least we won't starve to death if. And that's the thought I want to leave you with. We're never going to get everything we want, but we won't starve to death if. Really, take that. That's what I want you to walk away with. Walk out into your neighborhoods and stop thinking about, you know, whether you can have a new car, a new TV, and think about whether you could survive there if you and all the people you see in your neighborhood grew food. If the answer is no, you have to move. I think that what people mean by free is simply not suffering too much. So if freedom is not suffering too much, I would recommend trying to avoid the future of suffering that is coming our way. I'm serious. You can go look at the oil reports. Go to the peak oil websites and just read about the oil reports. There are no real investments in this stuff that moved us from the point where only a few wealthy white landowners consider themselves free to the point where everybody considers themselves free. When that plentiful oil goes away, we go back down to those few wealthy, whatever the skin color, probably white landowners who are well invested in the markets enough that they're in the 1% to hire people to work as serfs on the land that they run, because everybody's going to need to eat and you'd rather work for somebody knowing you have an allotment of food and kick some taxes up than be out there in the badlands. Anyway, my name's Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. See you next time. Thank you. I, believe it or not, struggle with whether to post things about religion. You wouldn't know that, but I always struggle a little bit. It's like, well, I, you know, people I like are religious. But then I feel compelled to tell the truth. As far as I can see, that this isn't an historical thing. Maybe you should know a little bit about why I've come to that conclusion and how I got there, just so you don't think, you know, that I don't care or that I think that spirituality is crap or something, because I don't think spirituality is crap. I'll talk about it. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic, funded by you. PayPal links are around. Any donations are much appreciated. So, should I tell you about how I grew up? Should I tell you about my leanings my whole life toward Eastern artifacts, toward Eastern philosophies, my fascination even before I understood it with the yin and the yang symbol, my studies in macrobiotics and Chinese medicine, Chinese philosophy or Asian Eastern philosophy, a little Ayurveda? Should I tell you about all of that, or can you just intuit it? Will you just guess? I think that it's easy for most people to hold to some notions of religion because they've never really investigated it. I think that once you really investigate it with a clear critical mind toward how human beings develop and frame their historical monuments, beliefs, habits, rituals, and then religions, you walk away understanding that religion is a process that comes through culture. So let's say, and let me give you the Liam's overview of how culture works. Culture works on the basis of energy and environment. Nobody really talks about this, and you know, as close as anybody's gotten, I guess, as far as I can see, Marvin Harris really gets close, and Jared Diamond does. He takes a long time to say it, but he kind of gets it, I think. That it is the, well, no, he gets it, that the it is the environment that makes the culture. And so it is the local environment that elicits the qualities of the religion. And I'm going to talk about how that happens, and I'll try to make a couple clear examples. So let's say that we have two cultures. And we're going to look at energy inputs and how much energy is available and then how the culture responds. One culture lives on a series of, an archipelago, a series of islands. And the islands live in warm, temperate waters full of fish, full of edible seaweed, crabs, shellfish. The islands themselves are fairly large. They're no longer actively volcanic. The soil is rich, potatoes, tubers, you know, yams, sweet potatoes, manioc, other things grow in the forest, and they've learned to cultivate them over long, long periods of time. We'll talk about that. And there are wild pigs that run around. They're dangerous, but you can catch them once in a while. And sometimes they've learned to kill the adults and breed the babies. So they're, you know, they're almost starting to inbreed them and domesticate them a little bit over long periods of time. But more plentiful than that and much easier is fish. You just go and you spear a fish. They also are, the island's full of coconuts, and again, they eat the roots, and they have figured out how to shave the starches and digest them with a little bit of, you know, spit and some enzymes and to ferment some things to make it all edible and to build pits in the ground that you put, you know, the burning husks of things, and you make a fire down there and you roast things for periods of time to disassemble the carbohydrates and fats and proteins so they're much easier to, or the carbohydrates and proteins so they're easier to digest. Okay. So you have this wonderful island life. It rains. You can count on the rain overnight in the morning. It never really gets cold. You can swim all year long. Your skin is a nice brown color because you've been there for so, your people have been there for so long, and you've adjusted through the germline. You've adjusted to the environment, because that's really what evolution is. We adjust to the environment. It's not the other thing. I'll do a whole video on evolution, but it's a great life. You think it's a great life. Now, you have totems there. You have rituals and you have rules. But let's go visit this other group. Now, you have another group and they live in a dry, dusty, hard, rocky, mountainous area. It's there's a little bit of water underground. There are no real lakes. There's a salt water sea to your side, and it is difficult to go to find fresh water except in springs. So you begin to have habits around the guarding of water. You have habits around the herding of animals because you can't grow a lot, so you have to herd these sort of tough animals, sinewy animals, goats and certain kinds of sheep and ungulates that you can push along the land and it's, you can't raise pigs because the pigs don't get to cool down, so they roll in their own feces and get worms. So you have a, you develop a habit. You learn this. Now this is how society, this is how civilizations and religions come about. This dry desert tribe has the habits of saving water, of managing population very strictly, because they don't have enough to go around, so they have to manage population, which means it has to become a habit that women cannot mate with anybody they want to. And the mating of the female has to be done on a schedule, and of course, the women and men have to be in charge. But over time, the easiest way to do that is to make women feel embarrassed about the fact that they're fertile so often, and then to shame them. So you have this dry desert mountain society tribe that is unable to really procure enough food to just let the population expand without checks. And the checks become enshrined in the minds of the people as shame, as habitual remembered shame. And then there are stories that come about because you remember the shame. Well, you remember when so-and-so did this, and then the story gets bigger and bigger, and it becomes kind of canon, right? And they say, well, do you remember when this happened? And the story's suddenly magical, and there's a figure, a goddess from the top that tells the woman how to behave, and then the goddess goes away because they don't want to empower women too much, so there's a god at the top of the mountain that tells the women how to behave, and the men. You see how the habit formed out of the geology and the environment, the energy coming into the society developed the pattern of belief inside of that society. Women had to be managed. Men had to manage women. You had to manage animals. You had to have rituals for how you sacrifice the animals. And out of superstition and out of a remembrance for how hard it is to live, you have to sacrifice some animals and give some of the animal's body to the god, almost as a reminder to people not to be greedy. There's somebody who can take all this away from us, and it's just called nature. The nature of this land, the environment that we're in, will take everything away from us if we're not flinty and frugal and conservative to the extreme. Now, over here in the lovely tropical islands, there's food falling from the trees, and there are no rules really about sex. People start having sex at a very young age in their teens. They begin experimenting with sex, and nobody cares because an extra child is not a problem, because the more children, the better, because some are going to die, because maybe there are snakes on the island, because maybe there are storms, and every once in a while somebody gets washed out to sea, or because people die and we want to replenish, but there's no shortage on food, so we don't have to hyper-vigilantly manage the breeding of the female. So a habit forms, and then the habit becomes, well, kind of a custom. And the custom becomes a ritual. And the ritual is enshrined in a series of stories. Then there become a group of people who remember those stories better than others. We can call those priestesses or priests, medicine men and women. They remember the story. They enshrine the story. And that becomes the religion, as much as these tribes have religions. Now, back on the mountain, where people are afraid to breed out of step with what the land, but they don't think of it as what the land can produce. They think of it as what their god will allow. And you can see in this one moment how what the land can produce and what the god will allow became the same thing. No joke. That's how religion comes about. And if you haven't figured out, we're talking about the ancient Hebrew religion and then any of the islands, Trobian, Hawaiian, the Cook Islands. You're talking about these islands where people had a lot of food and they really didn't have tough rules about sex and they didn't manage females in the same way. And relationships could flow more easily because everybody was on the island. Where are you going to go? You're all in the tribe. You're all going to support each other. And it's fine to have children by different people over the course of your lifespan because they're all going to be supported in island life. There in the dusky desert tribe where it's hard to get, you're surrounded by enemies, people who are not in your tribe. And they're enemies because they didn't come up with you. They're from over here or over here. Now, their lifestyle is very similar to yours because they grew up in a similar environment, but they're not you. And you think that that makes them very different because they have a different name for their thunder god than you do. And you fight them and you decide that you can kill them. And then you rationalize killing them because your god tells you that you're the people. Now, on the island, they don't interact with that many other people. They're just on the island, so they're the people, and they sort of have to tolerate or get along. But there is another island way up here, way over here, there's another island. And those people are different, even though their lifestyle is very similar. And every once in a while, there are raiding parties, and they go, and they do the most insane things. They actually commit acts of cannibalism. Why would they do that? They're not out of food. They do it ritually. They do it because sometime in the ancient past, they fought, or they isolated from each other, or they Well, I have to think about it. Why do people cannibalize? There are arguments about that. I almost didn't mean to bring that into discussion. But you will get, and by the way, in Europe too, and everywhere that you go, you will find evidence of cannibalism. And in all of our rituals, you will find evidence of cannibalism. Eating the god's body is cannibalistic. And that mutated our societies. All of our societies may have evolved or come around from societies which warred intertribally and would sometimes take the loser of a fight as food in remembrance of their loss. This is fairly common in very, very, very ancient history in ancient tribes, and you can still find it today, where the other tribe is considered so inhuman to you that you can actually eat them. Then, as society moves along, they remember that as eating the god's body, and then they begin sacrificing not humans, and isn't that the Abraham and Isaac story? That the ancient Jews would have moved from a place of human sacrifice to animal sacrifice. And the story that's being told in Abraham and did I just say it wrong? I just lost it. But in Abraham, where he had to bring Isaac to the mountain and kill him, but Yahweh said no, is a remembrance of the change from the point where they were committing intertribal cannibalism and that kind of ritual murder for, well, more organized warfare defending the rights of the tribe. I realize I didn't cover the cannibal thing enough. I'll come back to it. There are arguments for why cannibalism came about. None of them are totally satisfying. One is protein deficiency, as the Aztecs, the Central Mesoamericans. Why did they raid each other all the time? Essentially for food. The argument is that they ran out of food in the jungle. There were too many of them. They were too successful. They overhunted the jungle. And then they began hunting each other. The central, Aztec religious process was to take people from outside of their group and bring them in and sacrifice them. But that was a dead-end system, and you can tell the system's running down when it gets to that point. So we start with an idea, and that comes out of a climate and an ecology and an energy input. And then we go to an idea of remembering it, not as the energy input, because there's no way to remember that. Oh, we have a limited energy input, we have to do this. Oh, shut up. The god says don't do this. Oh, what do you mean? Shame. Everybody, shame this person. Shame, shame, shame. Don't do that. Don't lift your skirt. Don't lift your skirt for anybody. You can only lift your skirt for somebody in your tribe who you're married to. That is how we remember population management. And I think that we remember cannibalism in the Eucharist, in eating the body of the god. And this, by the way, isn't an idea that I came up with on my own or without much precedence, but this is all over the world. You know, ancient tribes move from a period where they're very aggressive with outsiders to the point of killing them and sometimes eating them, to the point where they prefer to take them as slaves because their society becomes organized enough that they actually prefer to have the work and the labor. But that's a different story. What happens when you move from a tribe that only accepts itself to a multi-tribe or even a civilization which accepts people from different tribes is you have to have an underclass. You have to have people doing the hard work, and you have to have tolerance. So instead of having a one mind about everything, you now have to have an overlord called a government, and the government is willing to kill any of you should you go and try to eat each other. So we move from a place of habit formed by the environment to custom, which is something that has proven through habit to be useful in the local environment, to ritual, which is a remembrance of the thing as a religious totem, to the religion itself, which binds it in a story and gives you a priest class. That's one group. When you have to have groups living together, you have to put them under a government which is willing to play the part of the other tribe. The other tribe is always willing to kill the outsider. The government is always willing to kill us should we not participate according to its laws. Anyway, that's a stab, to use that colorful word, at trying to explain to you how we come about in these groups that we seem to inhabit. It is to say that there is no free society because the government has to mildly have a blade out that we know that could come for us if we do something that that the government tells us is terrible. Now, the government gets its marching orders from a collective sort of blurry memory of that old tribal ritual, custom and religion. So you know, in a big government like ours, in a big country like ours, the old religious rituals may not have any meaning, but the government has to enforce them because it's the other tribe, and it has to scare us into behaving. Anyway, I'll come back to this. I think this stuff's interesting. My name is Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. All donations are much appreciated. In America, we really don't have much of a choice. We're either religious or we're scientific. And when it comes to religion, we have no choice at all. Our parents lie to us because their parents lied to them and read from storybooks that they don't understand. They've never asked the historical value of these storybooks because it's considered unholy to do so. Then you get to be older and you either reject them, which leaves you swimming in the abyss, wondering what the world is because you've only been told one story, a very peculiar story in all of world religion. Very peculiar stories, not one given to easy spirituality, much more of Levitical, a law-based code than a spiritual code. Or you cling to science, which tells you that anything from religion is crap, therefore you have to inject people with poison. It's very tiring to live in America and have a brain. It's really, really hard. It's hard to live in America and have a mind that works on all levels. It's really fucking impossible. I guess I'm just going to talk about that. This is American Heretic. My name's Liam Sheff. Well, I already started the conversation. I was talking... don't give away any names. Okay. I was talking with somebody who I know, who is an activist, who you don't know, against something, for something, whatever. And the conversation turned to religion. And he or she had a conversion experience that... I'll pick a she. She had a conversion experience that, you know, she was sure that religion was true in some fashion. Of course, I got the sense, as with most Christians, that religion, it wasn't religion that was true, it was her version of religion that was true, which means you can throw it all out because it was ruined by somebody at some point, but you know it's true anyway. Now, if this person, let's say, is against something like pharmaceutical drugs, right? Oh, I'm against pharmaceutical drugs for certain processes. I'm against pharmaceutical drugs for psychiatry. Okay, let's say that that's the issue. I'm against pharmaceutical drugs for psychiatry, but Jesus is true. To be against pharmaceutical drugs for psychiatry, you have to read medical literature, which means you have to accept data and history. You actually have to look at historical literature and scientific or medical data, and then you have to make a decision. And the decision that you make has to be about whether you're going to trust the word of people who don't accept criticism, that's the pharmaceutical community, or you're going to trust the criticism. Those are the people who have been negatively affected by their magic pills. So in other words, to be a health freedom advocate, you have to use critical thinking. You have to come forward and say, I'm going to use critical thinking. I'm going to look at this history where you say, magically we've cured diseases by injecting people with poison, by giving people drugs for a sex disease that we said they had when we gave them a test that does come up positive for everything, but don't worry about that. You have to just trust them, but to be a health freedom advocate, you say, I'm not going to just trust you blindly because I have an emotional response that feels good when I'm in accord with authority, like all monkeys do. All human monkeys have the habit of feeling good when we're in accordance with authority. Oh, authority likes us. What a good boy am I. You remember being favored by the teacher in school? Here's a star. Here's a star. Here's a little gold star. You repeated everything just like a good little vomit machine. There you go. Glad that, and you feel better, and nobody can deny that you feel better for having performed like a vomit machine that remembered everything that your teacher told you. And you may even start to believe it. But to be a health freedom advocate, you can't believe what the vomit machine teachers tell you. You have to come forward and say, I've read the cancer literature, I've read the HIV testing literature, I've read the chemotherapy literature, I've read the vaccine literature, I've read the psychiatric literature, and these drugs, injections, pills, tests, etc., are problematic, fraudulent, disputed, should be reconsidered for this variety of reasons, which I can list in chapter and verse in a logical way that anybody can understand, but Jesus is real. Fuck. Why? What? So the health freedom community as it exists is very, very infected with the dichotomy of the human experience. And the dichotomy of the human experience says, in order for me to reject one authority, I have to gobble up the effluence of another. For me to accept the absolute fraudulence of the health of the scientific establishment, I have to accept the absolute veracity of the late Roman Empire, of the late Roman imperial charge that we all believe in a sun god and pay taxes to the emperor come Christ, really? Emperor/Christ. We actually have to believe that there's no room for kajiggering there, that the Roman destruction of the Jews didn't help the Jews rebirth themselves as a different identity that would get along with the Romans. We can't think about history at all. We just have to accept ancient superhero stories as absolutely true if we're going to question scientific authority. This is a terrible, terrible problem, and this is a problem that I don't expect to solve in the remainder of this video. It is a problem, though, that haunts the health freedom community. Now, it may, in fact, haunt me or people like me, if there are any other people like me, there are very few, who question both sides. Because when the United States begins to contract and collapse, the Jesus people will all have each other. Now, a word about Jesus people. They don't agree about anything. None of them do. And none of them read the Bible. None of them actually read it and say it's true. They say, this line here I like, and skip, 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 skip. Don't, oh, you're misinterpreting that. Don't read that. Skip, skip, skip. Oh, that was changed by one of the councils. Skip, skip, skip. Oh, I like this line. Skip, 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 skip around, skip around. Oh, okay. Yeah. Don't look at the fact that the Torah was actually just was recapitulated in short form in some of the things called the Testaments, that the Gospels as they are just sequels to each other, embellished like remakes or reboots, or, you know, Spider-Man rebooted, Spider-Man re-rebooted and re-rebooted, that there's no character at all that's consistent from book to book to book, that originally the story was of a traveling mystic it was Marcion, I think, of... there was a guy in northern Turkey, and I don't want to get too much into this, but there was a guy in northern Turkey, and maybe the names will get back to me. And then there was another guy, I think, Apollonius or Apollonius of Tyria, I think. And there were these figures. And then there was the guy in northern Egypt called Philo of Alexandria. So you have Marcion of Sinope, right? So you have Marcion of Sinope over in Turkey, and you have Apollonius of Tyria, I believe, and then you have Philo of Alexandria, and there are these figures in quasi-history, although Philo of Alexandria is absolutely front and center in history, who end up saying a lot of the things and being a lot of the characters in Jesus Paul-isms, and then they're remade, rebooted, fictionalized, turned into a story that is absorbed by the Jews who were being indoctrinated or changed their minds by Greek influence, because Alexander the Great took over the entire world for a period of time, so Greek thought permeated the ancient Hebrew tribes. I'm serious, you can go look up history, but try to have a conversation about history with people who say that Jesus is their best friend. I always say to my religious friends, if you had grown up in India, you would be a Hindu. And every time that a spirit visited you, you would have a different name for it, and nobody would give you a hard time. and it would be fine with me, because we don't, because we're a spiritual being coming out of the electromagnetic matrix of an unknowable infinite universe. And even the ancient Jews, even the ancient Hebrews wouldn't let you say the name of the thing that they called the thing that was the most important thing, which was the mountain god, who was really one in a pantheon. Let's face it, it was one in a pantheon with a girlfriend, Asherah, and all kinds of other remaining gods, until they were at war so much they just favored the mountain war god, because they were at war all the time, so they figured they better just hedge their bets. Didn't really work out for them anyway, and they were run under by civilization after civilization after civilization, because civilization is built on having enough resources, not on whether your god is great or not. That's why the Jews lost over and over and over again, were absorbed by the Greeks then by the Romans, and then the Jews by the Romans, and then the Hebrew identity was crushed by the Romans, altered itself, gave itself a new name, took the sayings of Philo of Alexandria about gnosis and logos, and how you don't have to follow Leviticus anymore, and you just have to know, you just have to have your experience, and then there was Marcion of Sinope, who was perhaps a son of a wealthy shipping magnate who would have traveled a lot and had experience with the various stories, and then there was Apollonius of Tyria, who may or may not have been real, whose life really mirrors, prefigures that later was rewritten as Paul by Marcion. So you've got actual history, and then you've got the Star Wars movie. Imagine if George Lucas's life were examined. Would he, when he grew up racing cars in Modesto, would he not have seen people who reminded him of Han Solo? Was he himself not a kind of a Luke Skywalker searching for the meaning of it all? Right? So you have the actual history, and then you have the story that comes later. And in the health freedom movement, they don't want to know about that. They're focused on the CDC. Good, focus on the CDC, but why do you have to throw yourself to the late Roman tax collectors in the Catholic Church? And then they break away from it and they say, no, that Jesus didn't have anything to do with that. Jesus was about this. I'm sorry, did you know the motherfucker? Did you actually hang out with him? Please don't tell me that you did, because then I'll know you're crazy. Please don't tell me that you're actually hanging out with a magical figure who's in your head. Please don't tell me that you're breaking bread with him, or that you don't see the roots of ancient cannibalism in breaking the bread of a god and eating its body and drinking its blood. You don't see the actual ancient progression of religion from the practice of eating people to animals to grain. That's what we're talking about. But you can't talk about history, and you can't talk about anthropology with people who get Jesusified. Now, again, this may just work against people like me, because I don't favor the scientific answer to it, which is inject people with poison and don't worry about the nature of the world and don't worry about the soul of the world. The world has a soul. The universe is alive. The universe is electromagnetic. The mind of the universe is present in all things and makes all things. Tatvamasi, thou art that, is as true as an answer to what we are as I've ever heard. I've had many mystical experiences. I have them all the time. Nobody comes down from the clouds and talks to me. Life is a mystical experience. I don't need it to be wrapped up in human form. Doesn't it seem suspicious to you that every time you worship a god, he looks like a person? Don't you think that's ego? Don't you think that's puerile arrogance, that you imagine that the god of the world looks like a fucking person? I'm so bored with it, I could puke. And then I walk back into the health freedom community, and people stand up and start meetings with Praise Jesus. Can you please stop it? Can you knock it off? Could you just say, the mystery of the world is enough? We're going to respect the mystery of the world. We're going to respect the soul of the universe. We don't have the right to name it. We don't have the right to absolutely name the spirit and soul of the universe according to some limited, minuscule tribal identity. No, Liam, we need to. I know that that's the answer. I know. And the benefit for the Jesus people is they all get together in their meetings. And I sidetracked myself before, but the good thing about Jesus people is they all disagree with each other, but in a hard time, they'll all come together saying, you believe in Jesus? Yeah, but black Jesus. Yeah, but gay-loving Jesus. Yeah, but, you know, gay and lesbian loving Jesus. Yeah, but gay-hating Jesus. Oh, well, your Jesus is my Jesus. But it's better than the people who don't believe in Jesus. So they've already created their built-in tribal clan. And then when they get together, they'll all kill each other. Because, no, it's the truth. Because if you want to go look at what a religious cult looks like, it's hell on earth. Go to people who believe that one thing is the answer to all things. I've been there. I was sent to a cult when I didn't want to go there. I didn't ask to go there, but my mother's kind of nuts. And when I was, and I love my mother, but don't take it the wrong way, but she sent me to this crazy place when I was a teenager because I was sad and depressed for a number of very real reasons. And instead of talking about it and going through normal talk therapy, I had to go to this place called CEDU. And I can tell you that, and I'll talk about that in another video, but I can tell you that when people mystify one idea and hold you to that idea, everybody goes crazy. And it's just a giant cover for all of the abuses that you can possibly imagine. So there in the health freedom community, we have the emerging cult of the new form of Jesus. And the new form of Jesus is, we don't vaccinate, which is fine. You can heal your teeth by eating chicken hearts, which is not true. And eat as much cow liver and beef wrapped in bacon as you possibly can, and you'll live a long, healthy life. Also not true. And that's the end of the video. I'm out of time. I'm just coming off the top of my head. I don't know. With me, I'm going to be interested in how you treat people and if you can get along with people and if you can grow food together. But if you're an absolute believer in an absolute truth and you don't respect the mystery of the universe, you're a little scary to me. And I'm going to have trouble trusting your judgment at times. I'm sorry. It's just the way it is. Whatever. I'll see you. You go to your cult. I'll stick in mine. This is the Liam Sheff Show on UCY TV, Truth Frequency Radio. Please support the show by buying official stories at Amazon. There is a limit to activism in the United States, and I want to talk about that. There are activist groups like Black Lives Matter, like the Vaxxed movement, the anti-vaccine movement, and they're trying to make strong, sudden changes in the economic and political landscape and in the pharmaceutical landscape in America. They want to make those changes but leave some of America standing. They're going to find, as are we all, that America's going to change but not the way they want it to. And that they're not going to be successful in making the changes that they want. So what I'm going to do is provide for you a more realistic view of this country, as I hope to do in all of my videos, to provide you with a more realistic, more philosophically accurate view of how the world works. My name is Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. My books are my book is Official Stories. You can find it on Amazon. You can support this by putting $1 or $5 or $20 into the PayPal. So, Black Lives Matter. Now, you know that if you've been on the internet, there are protests scheduled for Friday. That would be, I think, the 15th of July. I'm sure those will end in some tragedy and horror for some people because they're a bad idea. There were a number of people killed by police, and that was put on camera, on video, and in photo, and that was shocking to people. And so there's a movement, Black Lives Matter. Of course, the name is polarizing, as most things the black community does are, you know, polarizing. I remember when Spike Lee's early 90s movie came out, I was living in Philadelphia, talk about a tough town, and everybody, and I was a young, rather idealistic, you know, 21-year-old, and I just felt like people could understand each other if they tried, but encounter an African-American person and said, "You're not black, you wouldn't understand." So this is a community that very much wants to have a separate identity. And there's a psychological reason for this. It's because that the ancestors of this community in this country were brought here by force. You know, brought here at the end of a musket, a saber, a sword, a gun. So, you know, there's still a resentment of and a confusion about black identity. What is it to be in a European, the primary descendant of European culture, speaking the primary descendant of European languages, English, Anglo-Saxon, and to be absorbed in the American culture, which is, you know, the should I say the apogee, the apex of all things capitalist, European, Adam Smith, etc. So you're here, and when you go to university, you might encounter The Wealth of Nations or Charles Dickens, and you wonder where your ancestors are. So you go into black studies, and you know, you discover some of the kingdoms of Africa, and you discover that Africa was a hot and very uninhabitable place in most parts, and that there were some settled kingdoms, and that it was geographically dependent. And then you might study Shaka, and you might study the Congo and King Leopold. You might study a lot of things, and you don't have to have any particular skin color to know about history. But to participate in America, then, as somebody whose ancestors were brought here, is going to be a bit crazy-making for you. So it is still that the most prized professions for young black males are, you know, gangsters, rappers, and sports stars, sports celebrities, basketball players, football players. Well, this is kind of terrible, but you get it. You know, how do you identify with the culture, the intellectual culture that enslaved all your people? So the black community has always been in a terrible, terrible catch-22 when it came to being in America. The black community also doesn't like to go back to its roots, which are agricultural, because they were slaves when they worked in agriculture. So it's difficult for the black community to say, we're going to embrace agriculture. The black community is urban, it is hip, it has its own lingo, it has its own products. Nevertheless, it lives precisely in the American ecosystem, the American petroleum system. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Now, the vaccine, the anti-vaccine community is intensely diverse, people from all socioeconomic and ethnic backgrounds, religious backgrounds, whose children have been damaged or killed or permanently disabled in some horrifying way by vaccines. Now, they want there to be an exemption against vaccines, an open discussion about the dangers of vaccines, or a repeal of all mandatory vaccines. Most people in the anti-vaccine community want some of those things. Some of them just want vaccines to be gone. But when they take the reasonable political stance, they talk about choice and lack of mandate, you know, just be able to choose. Because I think they figure that given the ability, given the lack of pressure on vaccinating people, more people will be likely to read, and they'll read why, you know, some people chose to become anti-vaccine, because they read, and they're dangerous, and they're full of toxic metals and mycoplasmas and other kinds of biological things that you don't want to inject into the human body. Another story, I've covered it many times. But you have these two activist groups, so-called black community. It doesn't really exist. It's, you know, just different people who don't have things in common, who have skin color in common, or they have some childhood memories in common because they ate the same media diet, or they grew up in the same city or the same town, or they grew up in different cities, but they both had communities that were outside of the so-called white community. Now, again, the white community doesn't really exist. You know, if anybody who's not a direct descendant of Africa is white, that's problematic. From Japanese, Chinese, Mongolian, Hungarian, German, Austrian. I mean, Austrians, Germans and French don't get along. Italians and Germans don't get along. The Danish and the Germans don't get along. Maybe it's the Germans. Just kidding, that's an accident of history. All right. So we get up and we decide to protest. And we're going to protest people being killed by cops. And so there's an effluence, you know, suddenly a flow of articles about how to reform police forces. And they're meaningful, and they make it onto Facebook. Your news echo chamber, you know, the place that you go to hear what you already think. It's a way that they contain our minds, by the way. We go into Facebook, and they contain our minds by reflecting to us with fake, totally fake news sites like your newswire.com, don't post anything from there. It's fake. It's just fake. And what's the other one? Examiner.com, just fake. There's a lot of fake stuff out there. And it goes through these communities of aware people. And we keep getting these echo chamber sounds about how things are getting better. They're not. They're not getting better at all. But the activist community comes out, and they're going to do something. They're going to have a protest. They're going to do this. They're going to stand on the street, and they're going to block traffic. Now, you know that when you call yourselves this, our lives matter, and yours don't, you're letting people know that they're supposed to hate you. So you send that message. Then you block traffic, which lets everybody who doesn't know anything about you think you're an asshole. Terrible, terrible strategies. You're not thinking long-term, even in a political sense, about what the results are going to be. You're just angry, and you're cruising for a bruising, and you're asking other people to join you, and it's going to be a problem. Not to say that laws shouldn't be reformed. They should, but they're not going to get reformed, not by activism, and really hardly by anything at all. Now, the vaccine community isn't out there blocking traffic like Black Lives Matter, but they're showing a movie called Vaxxed, Andy Wakefield's movie, Del Bigtree's movie, very powerful, very important, you should see it. And they are trying to pull back the California, there used to be an exemption if you didn't want to have your child vaccinated, and that's gone now because the crazy psychopaths, that's psychopathic scientists, you know, crowd decided that it was wrong to let anybody think about what to do with their own children in terms of their health care. And nobody reads the medical literature on vaccines, so nobody's aware of how dangerous they are, except the people whose children have already been ruined and destroyed or killed. So it's a very sad story. Now, if sad stories like people being killed by cops or people being brought here by on ships at the point of guns and swords, or people being killed, children being killed, teenagers being permanently disabled, horribly disabled by a bloody damned vaccine. I mean, look, if tears were enough to change laws, I suppose it might matter, but they're not. And the idea of changing a law is also relatively unimportant. I'm going to tell you how things actually work, having set up the political ground for you. The only thing that matters in America is the economy. That's it. Selling vaccines is generally good for the economy, and having police officers is also good for the economy because it's a workforce, and it, you know, lets the prison economy keep going, keep getting to arrest people for minor infractions and fill the prisons with them. You also create the idea that we're a civil society because if we do anything wrong, somebody will come along and scare us or beat up somebody. So we have the police, not so much for our protection, but for the protection of the items that the state owns. The police are mostly there to protect the materials of the state. That's why they're hard to talk to. They're trained not to trust us. They don't walk beats anymore. They're not here to negotiate between us so that we understand our neighbors better. They're there to protect the state and to enforce a lot of arbitrary laws that were enacted for some reason to collect more and more taxes. But you can't do much about that because the thing that makes America work is the economy. And the economy is not made of money. The economy is made of energy. So, stopping traffic in the middle of the day is bad for the economy, and therefore you lose. You may be arrested and criminalized, and all the, you know, old people, the middle-aged people sitting at home going, serves them right, you know, block traffic, we're just trying to get to work, because they need to make money, and their sympathy is with the working man or woman. In other words, it's with the working stiff, the person who goes to a job they don't like very much to do something to bring back home paper, which is the equivalent of a good or something that you can trade for food. And I said the most important thing in America was the economy, but it's really energy. The reason activism won't do much is because we're in an energetic death spiral. Our large oil supplies of the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and then again of the 80s and 90s, especially the 90s, where we really harvested Saudi Arabia to its full potential, is on the decline. So the future doesn't look like a California in which everybody's happy, driving their cars to work all the time. 18 million people in the greater Los Angeles area all driving one of the two family cars that they own all the time, and then new kids coming up and driving those cars. The future looks like a Southern California without so many cars. it looks like a California in a severe water crisis that has to choose between animal agriculture and any other kind of agriculture and local agriculture, or feeding neighborhoods water so that people don't die of thirst. So the actual future doesn't look like the future which you imagine you can get a law passed to do the one thing that you hope the law does, because we're in an economic, energetic death spiral. I don't mean just California. I mean nationally. I mean internationally. We are in an oil death spiral. There is a lot of cheap, dangerous kerogen under the surface of the crust, but we can't get it. It's too energetically expensive. And if you saw the, you know, New York City-sized fires going on in the tar sands in Canada, you'll realize that extracting this stuff looks a lot better on paper than it does in a fiery holocaust. Now, the black community lives, as much as there is such a thing, lives like the white community, and as much as there is such a thing, it lives on oil. And all of what it does lives on oil. So the food that you're eating when you go to the stores that you go to in the black community that you support because they're black-owned businesses all run on oil. They're not black-owned, they're Saudi-owned, they're oil-owned. Everything runs on oil. When you protest vaccines but you don't give up your car and start growing food locally, I understand what you're doing. I understand the importance, but you're missing something. This system that you're protesting is on the decline, and protesting vaccines as a mandatory thing may be important. Growing food is more important. Growing food where you are. And if you can't grow food where you are because you have a limited water supply, like California, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, a lot of Texas, the list goes on and on and on. If you can't grow food because you're having significant drought, you're going to have to move. Instead of fighting to change the law in a place that's not sustainable, you're going to have to dolly back. You're going to have to pull back and see yourself in a broader landscape. And it's hard to do when you have a child who's been mortally wounded by a goddamn vaccine, or when you're out protesting because another young person who could have been you was beaten up by cops. You want to protest, but it's not going to do much. If you live in an area like Jacksonville or in Atlanta, where the protests often happen because the black communities are very active, and so is black capitalism, by the way, and so is black oil usage, because there's no such thing as a black community. We're all using oil. All of us are in the same community of people sucking at the oil teat, and there is no easy replacement. We're not going to have any replacement for oil. What we're going to do is come way, 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 way back to a manageable size of population, of culture, of expenditure, of travel, and it is going to be harrowing. The police are going to be involved managing crowds. The last place you want to be is in a protest. You want to be figuring out where you can live, grow food, stay alive, stay healthy, get to know your neighbors who are hopefully open-minded enough not to worry about your religion or ethnicity because they decide to look at the content of your character rather than any other thing. Very important to understand there are limits to activism, and the primary limit is called oil. Energy. If we don't have the energy to create a make-believe liberal society in which we all get to divide into our little sub-communities and buy all the stuff we want and call them black or white, we don't exist at all. Then we're going back to a feudal medieval era in which the 1% owns us all and we work the land. I guess we all get to be serfs again. I want you to go into your local Target or store or Walmart, and I want you to rewind everything that exists there back to the first thing that it was. Rewind everything. So if you walk by a container of almonds, rewind the almonds back into their shell, onto the tree, into a tree, and into an almond seed that burst into a tree that was farmed, that was planted somewhere, it was nurtured, it was watered. It had pesticides and fertilizers added to it. I want you to rewind everything you see in the store. Now, the container for the almonds is plastic. You rewind that back to the original plastic bits and then back to the petroleum mining, the drilling machines, the roughnecks working on the drills. I want you to rewind everything you see. You get it? Okay, let's go through the Target. Let's go. Let's go. So we're walking down the aisle. First, we're on tiles. The tiles are made out of linoleum, or some sort of fabricated stuff that is probably mostly based in oil. There's probably not any real rock in that. It's not some kind of marble floor in the Target, so we've got oil under our feet. We're walking along. We're pushing a cart. There's a little steel, some aluminum in that cart, a lot of plastic. So we're looking at mining operations in South America and Africa and somewhere in the Appalachians, and we're looking at more oil. So we're looking at the Middle East. We're looking at Venezuela. We're looking at parts of Africa. We're looking at oil, anywhere we can get it. And we're pushing the cart down. So we're pushing oil and metal down on top of oil. Now, to the right are the women's dresses and the bras and all the other stuff, that all the varieties of colorful shirts with the slogans and every other thing that girls and women are supposed to wear now. Rewind it back. It's mostly polyester. We're rewinding it back to oil. Okay, so the fibers just dissolve and they turn black and they hit the ground and they're just a pile of goo. There's a little cotton in there. There's no hemp in the store. There's a little cotton in there. The cotton goes back to the field. It goes back into the cotton plant. It's covered in pesticides. Those are made of oil. It's planted and picked and threshed by big machines, big combines and harvesters, and those are running on oil. The ground is soaked and soaked and soaked in petroleum gasoline fertilizers and natural gas fertilizers and hydrous ammonium, nitrogen coming in from the oil fields, compressed in cookers that take natural gas and make it into something we put on crops. And that's now in the clothes, and that melts back into oil, and there's a little bit of a cotton seed there, and there's a little bit of cotton fiber, but that all is picked and threshed by oil. So now we're walking the men's clothes, exactly the same thing, the boys exactly the same thing, hats, everything dissolves backward and backward and backward and backward into petroleum and into oil. No matter where we look, everything in the store is just starting to dissolve, or it's just seeing everything turning into black goo, and we wonder where to turn. We go to the CDs, of course, they all turn into immediately back into oil, into plastic, into petroleum. Everything there is made of petroleum. Everything that looks like a book, the paper is from South American rainforests that are cut down for this purpose. Trees that are planted just to be cut down to make cheap paperbacks so that we can have another gray novel right there in the Target. It's the only thing they sell, and it turns back into some tree, but that's cut down and the logs are brought on big, big trucks and cut by big things that run on gasoline and petrol and oil. So there's a little bit of wood and there's more petroleum. And the glossy cover is just oil. It dissolves back into the plastics and the dyes. And maybe there's a little bit of soybean dyes. Okay, now let's get out of here. What about DVDs? Same thing. Boom, back. There's a little of aluminum in there. There's a little thread of metal in there. That comes from mining operations in Africa, in Asia, in South America. The mining operations in Bolivia spew up a little bit of this metal, and we mine it and machine it, and that uses gas and gasoline and every other thing. And okay, there's nothing here that isn't oil. We don't even run through every section in the store, belts and ties and hats and everything. And now beauty products and every other thing that we put on our skin has some form. The bottles are oil. The bottles are petroleum themselves. They contain petroleum products. There's a little bit of lanolin from sheep. There's a little bit of plant stuff, and that was all put through giant factories. So what is here that isn't just swimming in oil? You look behind you, and the entire store is just turning into a black glob. So you run to the food. Finally, you'll be saved in the food section. So you get to the food section. Oh, okay, we're back, and there are the almonds, are right there, and you reach for them, and your hand gets stuck in the goo of the container, which is turning backward into oil, and the almonds were brought from 1,000 miles away from the almond groves of Central and Northern California, where they're growing it in water that's pumped from thousands of feet deep into the dried aquifer just to make almonds so that California can sell almonds to the world, even though the state is running dry and can't afford them. It's doing it, and it's using giant diesel pumps to bring the water up to water the almonds so they can be put onto trucks and made into stuff that can be sold at the Target. Oh my God, what are you going to... Okay, how about some... anything. You reach... Oh, there's a healthy beverage. You reach for the Target soy milk, and you put it in, and it just starts to dissolve in your hand, and your hand is getting covered. There's some soybeans there, but then there's the black. What is that? It's oil. It's petroleum. It's scientifically engineered soybeans. They're GMO. They take more glyphosate than anything on the planet. They absorb it. They contain toxins that kill insects, and they have to absorb and absorb and absorb petroleum products and petroleum byproducts, and the ground is filled with anhydrous ammonium to grow the corn. You try to get some corn tortillas and some corn chips, and the genetically modified stuff is all over the place. The glyphosate and the petroleum that it is contained in is just right there, and you let go of the cart, which is falling apart. It's just a little bit of metal and a lot of oil. Your shoes are now falling apart. They're entirely made of petroleum. Your clothes are entirely made of petroleum. You run to go outside. The sidewalk is made of concrete, which is old, which is rock and stone. It's carried here on the back of trucks and pulverized and put in giant machines and heated in kilns, all run by fossil fuels. You can't get away from it. The parking lot dissolves into a sea of sticky petroleum, and you're looking for some solid ground to stand on because the entire store behind you is crumbling because the entire thing is made of oil. And sometimes I try to explain to people why it's important to think about relocalizing food and culture and water collection to your town. And all you have to do is play the rewind game anywhere you go, and you'll get it. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. My name is Liam Sheff. I'm the author of Official Stories. This is American Heretic. If you learned something, the PayPal links are around. Grow food.